Welcome to Truth Will Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 16th of April 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com, and we are live tonight because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, good day, sir. How are you doing?
I've had better weeks, to be honest, but can't complain.
Well, we're just glad to have you here. We are very glad to have you here. We know you're still going through quite a time of it with those health issues that you had back then before Christmas. And obviously we're praying for you, and I'm sure the listeners are as well. And we're just glad that we've got you here and that you're talking to us, and we can have our conversation together on a Friday night. And I'm personally glad to be talking to you anyway. I look forward to our chats on a Friday, and I'm sure the listeners sure do as well. Well, I see that at moneytreepublishing.com they've got another one of your DVDs up there.
Yeah, finally got Communism by the Back Door, which I feel in many ways is every good as the first one. It's just that the first one was probably the most impactful, according to many people, the most impactful documentary for quite some time. So to follow it with another one was difficult, but I do think that people who do watch it will see, you know, the greatness in it, because it is full of hidden secrets and answers a lot of questions.
Yeah, it goes into all sorts of issues, doesn't it? It goes into what's going on in Hollywood, what was going on with the church, pornography, all the ways that we're being subverted, really.
Communism comes in different forms. This is the thing, whether it's a cult or, as you say, through the music or through the movie industry, it's many problems, and people don't really realise that.
And it's been a while since I saw it. Do you actually go into the original communism as well in it?
Yeah, obviously, you know, that plays a part in it with the Lenin and Trotsky and people like that. But what I didn't realise at the time was that the bankers had funded it and therefore controlled the Soviet Union even before World War II.
And it all builds up to show that this is what the New World Order is. It's just a continuation of communism. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly what was it Brezhnev who was giving an interview on YouTube and talking about how it is manufactured in other countries and takes many generations to get rid of it. And then he went missing as well. The KGB must have got to him.
Brezhnev. Yeah, I recall seeing the YouTube. And that's on moneytreepublishing.com. And I'm also going to put a link to it in the article. And if people go to the Truth Will Out Films advert that's in the right-hand sidebar at radioalbion.com, that will take you to Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. And that's at the moneytreepublishing.com site. And also on there, you'll be able to find Communism by the Back Door. Have you had any thoughts about putting Freemasonic Victors out on DVD, Dennis?
Yeah, funny enough, there was an episode missing. Although there's some versions up on the internet of the class as the full version, I actually changed one of the, I think it was part 20, but they uploaded the one that I'd already uploaded, but when I changed it, obviously this particular part I must have deleted by accident, and it took me a while to be able to find a copy in the same quality, which luckily I did, and so yeah, it's back on track.
So that will be out then soon with like an improved version with the chapter that's missing from the version that's online.
I would think so, because it was an important chapter, really. That's why I changed it. Before I realised it, many people had already downloaded the original one, what I put up.
I think I remember that happening. I think I remember that happening because as you were making it, we were sort of going through each episode as well and going in, going more deeper into it. And that was the version that hadn't actually been produced on DVD before, isn't it?
That's never been on DVD. That's right.
So that would be the first time that it's available on DVD. So that would be good. That would be a collector's edition for people to purchase.
Yeah,
And it's four DVDs in each box, isn't it? And $50 a set, I think.
Something like that, yeah. I mean, there was obviously a big discount to people bought each one. But, yeah, again, it's The Secret Masonic Victory again reveals a lot of hidden history. Even I was shocked at.
And a portion of that money when you purchase those DVDs, that goes to Dennis as well. So if you want to donate money to Dennis, that's the way to do it. Go and buy yourself some of those DVDs at moneytreepublishing.com. Well, tonight we're going to get back into Ingrid Weckert's Jewish immigration in the Third Reich. I'm not sure whether we will finish it tonight. We're actually up to episode 5. And tonight we've also got some notes that have been taken from Wikipedia. And just before we get into it, I'll just read out the disclaimer that's actually from Ingrid Weckert's book. She says, "The purpose of this work is to elucidate the emigration process in law and policy, thereby augmenting the traditionally received picture of Jewish emigration from Germany during the Third Reich." And what we've really discovered over the last few weeks, I think, is a story that most people aren't aware of. They think that the Jews had all their possessions taken from them and they were put in the camps and they were gassed in Germany during the war. And what we've learned is that there was a program before the war to help Jews to emigrate mainly to Palestine, but also elsewhere. And the Germans were helping them do this. They weren't trying to keep them there and preventing them from getting out. They were doing all that they could to actually help the Jews to go to Palestine. And I've been quite surprised at how much work and how much work between the two there was. I mean, it's like there was an alliance there between the National Socialists and the Zionists. And the Zionists could see that what the National Socialists were doing was good for Germany, and they supported it. And the National Socialists supported what the Zionists were doing in Palestine. And they even sent SS officers out there to observe everything that was going on. And he wrote a series for a magazine about it. And that's who we were looking at last week. We were looking at Leopold von Mildenstein, who was the main SS officer that the Zionists worked with. And he ran the SS Jewish office. As I say, he spent time in Palestine observing how the Jewish pioneers were building their new country. He saw the solution to the Jewish question being emigration to Palestine. But unfortunately, Britain would only let 15,000 Jews legally emigrate there every year. So they did have another operation to help Jews leave Germany, and that was the Rubley-Wolfat Agreement, which put procedures in place to help Jews emigrate to countries other than Palestine. But after pledging to do this, most countries refused to openly accept them. And once the war had started, rather circuitous routes were arranged to get the Jews to America, South America, and Russia to try and get them out of the war. So even once the war was going, it was preferred to help to get the Jews out of Europe to wherever it was that they wanted to go. This idea that they wanted to just put them all in camps and exterminate them, when you look into this, that isn't what they wanted to do. They wanted to help these Jews to get to wherever it was that they were going. This narrative that they wanted to exterminate them, there's very little evidence for that. I mean, what is their main evidence for that, Dennis? Do you know?
Well, to be honest, there's yet to be found evidence of one dead gas body. As you know, when you see all the pictures at the end of the war, these grief-stricken bodies were just piled up, that wasn't cause of a gassing. That was cause of lack of nutrition and food. So, you know, we have to believe the Bolsheviks and Stalin that there was actual gassings, especially at Auschwitz.
And also they claim that all the paperwork was got rid of. They just destroyed the paperwork, and they claimed that the final solution to the Jewish question, that the final solution meant execution, whereas what we would suggest that the final solution was exporting the Jews to a country of their own, which is really what the Germans were doing with this Havarah agreement. But there was also plans for Madagascar, wasn't there?
That's right, yeah. I think the problem, well, the main problem really, is the fact that it can't be investigated. After World War One, when the Germans were accused of crucifying Canadians and putting Belgian babies on the end of bayonets, it was investigated after the war and proven a lie. But after World War Two, such investigations were restricted, especially in the Soviet Union, as they are today. And the fact that in some countries, if you cannot even mention the fact that it's a dubious claim, then you could be looking at prison.
Well, in actual fact, 15% of the Jews that were in Palestine came from Germany. So, I mean, that's quite a portion. That's a fifth of the country that started building up Israel in Palestine actually came from Germany. And yet there's very little evidence about what was going on there. I've really struggled to find information about this, apart from Ingrid Weckert's book, and as we talked about last week when we looked at Leopold von Mildenstein, Wikipedia does actually bear out what she was saying in this book. It's just that we've gone into it in more detail. I think we've got some really surprising information this week that we're going to be getting into. The Jewish emigration continued even after the war. And principally, that was due to, first, the international connections of the Jews, and second, to the assistance of the German bureaucracies, and finally, to an organisation that was later to play a completely different role, the Mossad Le'Aliyah Bet. And this is the first I'd ever heard of this, that the Mossad was actually started at this time. And it was started to help the Jews get to Palestine from Germany. And it was started in alliance with the National Socialists. But today, the Mossad is responsible for intelligence collection, covert operations, and counter-terrorism. It is separate from Israel's democratic institutions. Because no law defines its purpose, objectives, roles, missions, powers, or budget, and because it is exempt from the constitutional laws of the State of Israel, the Mossad has been described as a deep state. Its director answers directly and only to the Prime Minister of Israel. Its annual budget is estimated to be around 10 billion shekels, that's $2.73 billion, and it is estimated that it employs around 7,000 people directly, making it the second largest espionage agency in the Western world, second only to the American CIA. The official story is that Mossad was formed on December the 13th, 1949, as the Central Institute for Coordination at the recommendation of Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion. He wanted a central body to coordinate and improve cooperation between the existing security services, the Army's Intelligence Department, the Internal Security Service, the Shin Bet, and the Foreign Office's Political Department. But the unofficial story is that it was actually formed over 10 years earlier as the Mossad Le'Aliyah Bet. And I'll just stop there because I find it really surprising that Israel is such a small country when you look at it, and yet it has the second largest espionage agency in the world, second only to America's CIA. I mean, it must be half the population of Israel that are involved in this. And you think how big the CIA is?
Exactly, yeah.
What do you make of this, Dennis?
Well, I think it's all to do with Israel's aim to, you know, for the New World Order to be in their charge.
Yes, we went into that before, didn't we, about how they've always had this drive to be controlling the world, and that is a drive that you would expect every nation to have, every group of people to have a drive to get to the top of the heap, as it were. And it just seems that we, as white people, have forgotten that we should even be having that drive, and we behave as if no other country has it, and every country has it, every nation has it, and particularly the Jews. Well, let's get into this story of the Mossad then. The Mossad Le'Aliyah Bet literally means the Office for the Second Immigration, which referred to the illegal immigration to Palestine. And that's because Bet is the second letter in the Yiddish alphabet, a Hebrew alphabet. And Alpha, Aleph, is the first one. So Mossad La Aliyah. Aliyah means going to Israel. Mossad means office, and Bet is the second. So it's the office for the second immigration to Israel, referring to all the illegal immigration that was going on. And it was out of this organization that later the Israeli Secret Service, the Mossad, developed. Jews from Palestine founded it in Paris in 1937 in response to Britain's Palestine policies. So this was 10 years before the official beginning of the organization. It was actually founded in Paris by Palestinian Jews, and it was in response to Britain's policies. The British were then issuing only a limited number of immigration certificates to Palestine, much fewer in any case than the number of Jews that were seeking entry. The British classed prospective immigrants according to wealth, profession, and class, and the certificates were distributed in these individual categories in numbers that reflected the desirability of immigration from each category. Anyone who did not fit into a category considered essential by the mandatory administration would not be granted a visa. So the Jews were really not very happy about this, and they were not very happy at the British for doing this, and the British came out with a white paper in 1939, which essentially said that they could, Palestine could only accept 15,000 Jews a year. So the Jews were very angry at Britain for doing this, and at the same time, the Arabs in Palestine were very angry with the British for allowing these Jews to migrate there in the first place. So the British were supposed to be looking after the place, and yet both populations, the Jews and the Arabs, were then anti-British, so that the British had a bit of a hard time of it from then, and a lot of illegal immigration continued. Do you want to add anything to that, Dennis?
I'm presuming this is around the time of Lawrence of Arabia. Am I right?
I think that was sometime before, wasn't it? I think that was the First World War, and he was upset at what had happened, at the way that the Arabs had been let down by this Balfour Declaration, I think.
Right, yeah, it was assassinated, wasn't it? My mistake, wrong war.
Yeah, it's very easy to do, isn't it? I was looking into this yesterday at the Arabs and the Arab response to this, and maybe we'll get into that a little bit more later on. Well, the following immigration categories were valid from 1932 to 1945. Category A, persons with their own capital. Capitalists possessing 1,000 Palestinian pounds. Professionals with 500 pounds, so long as the economic situation warranted their immigration. Craftsmen with at least 250 pounds. Pensioners with a minimum income of 4 pounds a month. Persons with work skills scarce in Palestine with a minimum capital of 500 pounds. So they're making sure that the people that actually go there have all got a certain amount of money, and Jews were sending money into Germany to fund this as well. And as we've talked about in earlier episodes, they set up all these loans, and Germany helped with this as well, and helped these Jews to get the money together so that they could actually go to Palestine. But then the problem that they now had was Britain saying, well, we're not going to let any more than the numbers we've already let in come in anyway. And then plus there was this, and the Jews weren't too happy about this either. Category B, persons with a secure income. Orphans under 16 years of age whose keep was guaranteed by public bodies. B2, clergymen. Students and pupils whose keep was guaranteed until their entry into the workforce. Category C, work certificates for workers between 18 and 35 years. The number of these certificates was audited by the Palestinian Authority twice a year. Category D, this category was reserved for wives, children and parents of Jews living in Palestine, as long as the residents could show that they were able to fully support their relatives. Finally, there was the category Jugendalia, youth aliyah, for youths between the ages of 15 and 17 years. So we can see here that they don't want any bludgers or scavengers. They want people that have got money and that have got skills and that are going to work, basically, coming to the place. So this is what I was saying before. It seems to me that it was only the, you know, the best of the Jews that were actually moving out there.
Well, to be fair, that's the policy of more sensible countries. You know, they're looking for people to improve the country and not hangers on.
A little bit different to the immigration policy today, isn't it? Where they just let anybody in. And who is it that is the loudest in calling for Britain and Europe to let anybody in? I would suggest that the loudest voices come from Jewish representatives.
Jewish, Angela Merkel.
Yeah, and Angela Merkel, of course. Jewish leaders were understandably furious at Jews being categorized on the basis of their economic value. The Palestinian mandate, entrusted to Britain on July the 24th, 1922, called for the British to support and to simplify Jewish immigration, whilst safeguarding the rights of other peoples in the country. Hence, from the inception of the restrictive measures, the Zionists attempted to find ways around them, and to send Jewish transports to Palestine illegally, in the eyes of the British. So, to the Jews, it was Britain that was sort of going against this agreement that Britain had actually made by saying that Jews had to have a certain amount of money and they had to have all these skills. And the Jews were saying, well, in 1922, you said you would support and simplify this, and you haven't. You've actually made it harder for Jews to get there. And then later, on May the 17th, 1939, the British published a new white paper which tightened the immigration regulations to just 75,000 Jews over 5 years. And in reaction to these events, in 1937, the Mossad began to establish offices in all the European countries and sought immediate contact with agencies in Berlin, in particular with the SS and the Gestapo, and thus began a lively collaboration between the Gestapo and the Mossad. And I think this is why this is sort of hidden history that you don't really hear about, because you just don't ever hear about the Mossad working with the Gestapo and the SS, do you?
No, that would be a shock to a lot of people.
Well, it's a shock to me. It's the first I've heard of this.
Yeah.
As befitted their attitude towards Jewish emigration, the SS and the Gestapo were helpful towards the Mossad agents in many ways. In December 1938, Himmler ordered that Jewish prisoners in concentration camps who desired to emigrate should be released. Additionally, Mossad agents were permitted to enter the camps to recruit Jews willing to go to Palestine in illegal migration ships. Nothing stood in the way of the release of such inmates. Kimchi writes, since he, that's Pino, the Mossad delegate, guaranteed the Gestapo that he would provide for their immediate emigration, Pino was in a position to get a large number of young Jews out of the concentration camps. A signed form from him sufficed to effect their release. So what we see here is the Jews that were in these camps would have been in those camps because they were enemies of the state. They would have been communists, subversives, people that were causing trouble, and yet the Mossad were willing to take them out and get them to Palestine and give them another chance, basically, and the Germans were quite happy to go along with that. And also this shows that there were representatives of the Jews that were walking around these camps, at least in 1938 they were. So they can't have been mistreated. You pointed that out last week, didn't you, Dennis, about how there wasn't this mistreatment in the camps?
Yeah, the other delegation from America came over to check it all out and reported they were in bad condition, good health, well looked after.
And the Red Cross were in the camps throughout the war. They weren't allowed in the Russian camps, the Soviet camps.
Oh, that's a whole different ballgame.
Since direct travel to Palestine was illegal, the emigrants needed visas from other countries, for example, from immigration authorities in ports that the ships would stop at on the way to Palestine. The Gestapo became involved in this as well as in the chartering of suitable ships, even covering part of the costs. So because they were only allowed to accept a certain number of Jews from whatever country, they would end up providing them with fake visas from another country that still hadn't reached its limit of Jews that it was allowed to actually send, as well as sending these ships there. And this is before the war has started, really, and they're already starting to get problems here. In 1939, a number of ships arrived in Palestine, bringing thousands of illegal immigrants to the country. The cooperation between the Mossad and the Gestapo did not end with the outbreak of the war. Indeed, it grew even stronger. Emigration papers were often made out for other countries, and the emigrants instructed not to reveal anything about their final destination. Without such help from the SS and the Gestapo, and without the silent acquiescence of the German authorities, the Mossad could not have done its work. In the summer of 1939, an operation was planned that would have shipped 10,000 Jews from German ports in a single convoy to Palestine. Before the ships could sail, however, war broke out and the English blocked the channel. So you can see here, there's another use of these visas as well. They're giving them visas saying that they'll be going to the south of France or they'll be going to Spain. And in actual fact, these Jews would have been continuing and going all the way to Palestine. Do you want to add anything to that, Dennis?
Not really, no. It's par for course, really. It's just a shame that the war broke out as it did. There would have been a lot of people gutted, like, who were looking forward to going down to Palestine.
Yeah, it shows that they had these policies in place that were going to benefit both the Jews, and it was going to benefit the Germans, and Jews that wanted to stay in Germany, they could have stayed there, but under the rules, they were there as guests. There were laws, and people had to obey the law. It's not like it was a free for all against them or anything like that. 2 years later, in summer 1941, the 1939 plan was revisited by Abraham Stern, one of the leaders of the IRGUN, the Jewish Anti-British Resistance and Freedom Organization. And he was the leader of, he must have ended up leading the Stern Gang. The Stern Gang and the IRGUN were these two terrorist groups that fought against the British. So, again, you see that the Jews were against the British here, and supporting the Germans. He offered to help the Germans in their battle against England and suggested that Germany immediately begin to ship out 10,000 Jews in return. He was of the opinion that the German ships could break through the English blockade and bring the Jews to Palestine. And once they had arrived there, the English would then not be able to return them. Whether this suggestion ever reached the right ears is questionable, because the agents sent out by Stern were later imprisoned in Syria. In any case, Berlin had to regard breaking the blockade hopeless. A convoy full of ships, full of civilians, especially women and children, had little chance of reaching Palestine unscathed. The German government could not assume responsibility for such an enterprise. So Germany wouldn't have done that anyway, because they would have said it was too dangerous, but that was what the leader of the Stern Gang suggested as being a good idea. And this was Stern's second attempt at establishing contact with the German government. Half a year earlier, in January 1941, IRGUN had offered in a letter to fight for Germany against England, in particular through sabotage and spying in Palestine. In return, they demanded that the national aspirations of the Israeli freedom movement be recognised by the German Reich, and the establishment of a Jewish brigade with military training and organization of Jewish manpower in Europe under the leadership and command of the NMO, that's the National Military Organization, in military units that would play a combat role in the conquest of Palestine should that become a front. Now, I find this really interesting, because the mainstream story is all about the Mufti, the Arabs in Palestine, the leader of the Palestinian Arabs and the leader of the Muslim world, going to Hitler and saying, can we fight for you? We will fight for you against the British in Palestine. And apparently in the Mufti's autobiography, he says Hitler turned him down. It just says Hitler turned him down. He wasn't interested. Now, since then, the mainstream media has said, we have the actual notes that were taken at this meeting And I've looked at the notes, and it's not Adolf Hitler said this and the Mufti said this. It's somebody sort of writing it as if they're writing a story. And in this story, it has Hitler saying that he wants to get rid of Jewry entirely. And of course, he doesn't want them in Israel, and he wants to exterminate them all. And once the war is over, he's going to go and get rid of them all in Israel. And he's apparently saying, yes, we understand the Jews aren't doing any work there, and it's all the Arabs doing the work there. And that's the mainstream story. And that doesn't make sense to me, because 15% of all the Jews in Palestine were German Jews. We just heard about this SS officer who had travelled to Palestine and saw them doing the work and was very impressed, and had written this series for Der and Griff. And we've got the Jews offering to fight for Germany. We've got the Palestinian Jews offering to fight for Germany against the British in Palestine. And they're saying here that they want the German Reich to acknowledge the national aspirations of the Israeli freedom movement. So I think maybe they're trying to cover up this this collaboration between the Palestinian Jews and Germany, and they're trying to cover that up and make out that these Palestinian Jews were against Germany and supported England, whereas in actual fact, I think it was the other way around. And this story with the Mufti, that Hitler was saying he was against Israel and he knew that it was the Arabs doing all the work, I think that may have been elaborated on, just to put it bluntly. What do you think of that theory, Dennis?
Yeah, there was somewhere that I read somewhere that the Mufti and Hitler had planned for once the Germans had taken the Caucasus, they would then turn towards the Middle East, which again sounds, you know, I think there's enough on the plate as it were. So I won't be too sure about that theory.
Well, that comes from it as well. Again, that is from this supposed notes that were taken from the meeting between the Mufti and Hitler. That was part of it. They were going to get through the Caucasus, and then they were going to go in and they were going to completely smash the Jews in Palestine. Why would they go there and smash the Jews in Palestine when they'd been helping the Jews in Palestine build everything there? And they wanted the Jews to have their own country. They wanted them to have their own homeland. They had the idea that Madagascar would be the best place for it. But they had to be pragmatic. There was already this agreement for Jews to have a homeland in Palestine. And there was already a facility there for getting the Jews to go there. And the Mufti must have known this. I mean, these German Jews, it would have been known that they were coming from Germany. 15% of all the Jews in Palestine came from Germany through this agreement.
Why did you divert from the Soviet Union? It just doesn't seem logical to me.
Well, this story with the Mufti doesn't seem logical to me either. As you say, Dennis, they had their hands full with the Soviet Union. So yeah. I think it's a cover story.
It could possibly be, yeah. I just don't make sense of it, because the same, like, because of Stalingrad, it never came apparent. But I think even if they took Stalingrad and secured the oil fields, still have a lot on where they were, you know.
I think the truth is probably what the Mufti put in his book, that Hitler wasn't interested in helping with that project. And I know Hitler spoke out against Israel when he wrote Mein Kampf, but that was like 20 years earlier. And as I say, you had to be pragmatic. They were trying to find somewhere for the Jews to go, and they had somewhere in Palestine. And it was beneficial to them from what they could see of it. It was improving the character of these Jews that had actually gone there. That's what Leopold was saying. If you recall some of the quotes we had last week, he said it had really done wonders for their character to have these Jews actually building a country for themselves. So where do we get to here? The contents of the letter. So we've got Abraham Stern, and he's writing to the Germans, offering to fight for them. The main thrust of the National Military Organization in Palestine's proposal, and that's the Ergun Zivi Lumi. That no, it's not the Stern gun, is it? It's just called the Ergun. I guess we should just call it the Irgun, but another name for it is the National Military Organization in Palestine. Their proposal for solving the Jewish question in Europe and for actively participating on Germany's side in the war, the thrust of it was, Germany's leading National Socialist statesmen have, in comments and speeches, more than once emphasized that a new order in Europe requires a radical solution of the Jewish question through evacuation, Judenrein's Europa. The evacuation of the Jewish masses from Europe is a prerequisite for solving the Jewish question, which is possible only by resettling these masses in the homeland of the Jewish people, Palestine, and by establishing the Jewish state in its historic boundaries. To solve the Jewish problem in this way, and once and for all, to liberate the Jewish people in the aim of the political activity and the ongoing struggle of the Israeli freedom movement, the National Military Organization in Palestine, the Irgun Zivi Lumi, the NMO, which knows full well the goodwill of the Reich government and its authorities towards Zionist activity in Germany and towards Zionist emigration plans, is of the opinion that 1. A commonality of interest could exist between the interests of a new order in Europe according to the German concept and the true national aspirations of the Jewish people as they are embodied by the NMO. 2. Cooperation between the new Germany and a renewed folkish national Jewry would be possible. And 3. The establishment of the historic Jewish state on a national and totalitarian basis bound by treaty with the German Reich would be in the interest of maintaining and strengthening Germany's future position as a power in the Near East. And that's a quote there from the letter that was actually sent. What do you think of that, Dennis?
Well, it sounds reasonable, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's quite shocking though. It's not what traditional history tells us was going on between the Jews and the Germans, is it?
No, well, there's a surprise. Can you really vouch for anything with these in what they typify as the real history?
Well, again, it shows that, you know, nationalists, if you're a nationalist, you're going to get on with other nationalists. You're going to understand that you're doing your best for your people and they're doing their best for their people. And you're going to be able to get on. And that's the commonality of interest.
Today, aren't they?
Well, that's the commonality of interest that is there, isn't it?
Yeah. You know,
they can both be enemies and fighting a war at the same time in part of Europe, but at the same time also understand that there is part of them are nationalists and they want peace, and the way to have peace is to be looking out for your own people. And this is what these Zionists wanted. This is why Israel has a lot of the laws that the National Socialist State had. You know, they won't allow the Israelis to marry Arabs, will they? They have to marry other Israelis. And
that's true, yeah.
And you can't be a citizen unless you're actually an ethnic Jew. It's a nationalist state, and it had a lot in common with the National Socialist State, with the German state. Mm-hmm. Proceeding from these considerations, the NMO in Palestine, under the condition that the above-mentioned national aspirations of the Israeli freedom movement be recognised by the German Reich, offers to actively take part in the war on Germany's side. This offer by the NMO, which could include activity in the military, political and information fields in Palestine, and after certain organisational preparations outside Palestine, would be linked with the military training and organisation of Jewish manpower in Europe, under the leadership and command of the NMO in military units that would play a combat role in the conquest of Palestine, should that become a front. The indirect participation of the Israeli freedom movement in the new order in Europe, already in the preparatory stage, in connection with a positive radical solution of the European Jewish problem, in the sense of the above-mentioned national aspirations of the Jewish people, would extraordinarily strengthen the moral basis of the new order in the eyes of all humanity. A cooperation of the Israeli freedom movement would be in line with the last speech given by Chancellor Mr. Hitler that he would employ any combination and coalition in order to isolate and beat England. And that's close quotes there. And you just wonder what could have been if they'd had the Jews backing what Germany was doing. which is apparently what these Palestinian ones were doing. So again, this is why I'm saying I don't believe this story of Hitler was going to work with the Mufti to wipe out Israel as it was being built.
Because you can understand your point of view for sure.
Because this is who the Germans were working with, not with the Mufti. The letter was obviously sent at the same time that two of Stern's agents arrived to see Werner Otto von Hentig in Beirut. Hentig was an advisor in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. At the beginning of 1941, he was on an official visit to what was then the French Mandate of Lebanon. The conversation must have been similar in content to the letter, because Hentig wrote, "In Beirut, I took up residence in the Hotel Monopole. The most extraordinary delegation came from Palestine itself. The leader, a handsome young officer type, offered to work together with the National Socialists against their own people, especially the Orthodox Zionists, if Hitler would agree to an independent Jewish Palestine." And that's a reference from page 338. "I could only respond to the Jewish delegation that the offer of cooperation and the conditions stated could never be accepted out of consideration for our Arab friends and our general principles." And that was page 399. "The Ergun letter, written in German, arrived safely in Germany, but whether a German reaction followed cannot be ascertained from the files." So again, he's saying there that they couldn't accept this. One of them at least said that they couldn't accept this. So they were trying to be on good sides with the Arabs and the Jews, I think.
Yeah, difficult balancing act for sure.
And you had these communist Jews, and the Bolshevik Jews that were fighting the war against Germany, and then you had these banker type Jews in America that were agitating it as well. And then you had the Zionist Jews in Germany who were quite happy with what's going on. They wanted to be separate themselves, and they wanted to encourage the Jews to realize they were Jews and they weren't Germans. And again, you had this faction there in Palestine. And this faction became a very powerful faction. You know, the Stern Gang and Ergun, the Israeli Defense Forces came out of them. Basically, and some of them were prime ministers of Israel. So this isn't just a small group that doesn't have any influence. And again, you've got the Mossad, who grew to be the intelligence services of Israel. So these are really, powerful organizations, or grew to be powerful organizations. "The NMO arose in part out of the Jewish Self-Defense Force in Palestine and the Revisionist Movement, which is the new Zionist organization, with which the NMO remained in a loose union facilitated by Vladimir Jabotinsky until his death. The pro-English attitude of the Revisionist organization in Palestine made a renewal of the union impossible and resulted in a split in the fall of that year. The aim of the NMO is to establish the Jewish state within its historic borders. In contrast to all other Zionist movements, the NMO rejects infiltration of the colony as the only means of achieving occupation and gradual settlement of the fatherland, and proclaims as its motto that struggle and sacrifice are the only true means by which to conquer and liberate Palestine. Through its militant character and its anti-English attitude, and because of the constant persecution of the English administration, the NMO was forced to conduct its political activities and the military training of its members in secret. The NMO, whose terrorist activity had already begun in the fall of 1936, gained prominence in the summer of 1939 after the English White Book was published through its intensified terrorist attacks and sabotage of English property. At that time, virtually the press of the entire world reported and discussed this activity, as well as the NMO's daily clandestine radio broadcasts. Until the outbreak of war, the NMO maintained independent political offices in Warsaw, Paris, London, Geneva, and New York." So they were going to fight against the British anyway, because of the limited Jewish immigration that was going into Palestine, and they were offering to do that in alliance with with Germany. And they continued fighting against the British after the war. This is the origin of these terrorist attacks on the British. Because we've said, well, you know, how dare they do that after Britain's just fought this war and liberated all these Jews from these camps? And then they start attacking them in Palestine. Well, the point was that the Jews in Palestine were quite happy with what the Germans were doing. The Germans were helping them. They were exporting the Jews there. Very complicated, isn't it?
Well, it was good for both parties, like we've always said. So both are going to strive to help each other.
Like, what a tangled web we weave, isn't it?
It's got that way, certainly.
The Warsaw office was mainly concerned with the military organisation and training of the National Zionist Youth. It was in close contact with the Jewish masses, which, especially in Poland, enthusiastically followed the NMO's struggle in Palestine and supported it in every way possible. Two newspapers published by the NMO appeared in Warsaw, Die Tat and Jerozolima Wielazlona. The Warsaw office also maintained close contact with the pre-war Polish government and with military circles that regarded the aims of the NMO with interest and favour. Hence, in 1939, groups of NMO members travelled from Palestine to Poland, where they were quartered in barracks and their military training perfected under Polish officers. Negotiations between the NMO and the Polish government in Warsaw, aimed at actualising and concreting their assistance, were terminated due to the outbreak of the war. Documentation of this will be easy to find in the archives of the pre-war Polish government. In its worldview and structure, the NMO is closely related to the European totalitarian movements. The ruthless defence measures of the English administration, the Arabs, and the Jewish socialists have at no time sufficed to weaken or to paralyse the NMO's fighting ability. So that tells us that they were against the Jewish communists, basically. The Jewish socialists. Well, the illegal immigration to Palestine continued even after the war ended, right up until the founding of the State of Israel in 1948, because the British kept Palestine's borders closed to the Jews. In the decade from 1938 to 1948, over 100,000 Jews migrated to Palestine illegally. The total number that left Germany and Austria after 1933 cannot be ascertained statistically, because there was no counting at the point of departure or at the point of arrival. Estimates vary from 100,000 to 537,000, a discrepancy that reflects the unreliability of those figures. In actual fact, all figures, with one exception, remain guesswork and refer to different groups and times. There are no reliable figures that embrace Jewish immigration as a whole. Some authors construe it as confined to emigration from Germany within its pre-1938 borders. Others add Austria to their calculations. Some wish to focus exclusively on the years from 1933 to 1939, although it is clear that emigration continued after the outbreak of war and that illegal emigration to Palestine actually accelerated in 1938. There is only one figure that derives from an official German source that, however, is rejected by all establishment authors because it seems too high. Interestingly, this figure appears in a document that is otherwise highly regarded, thanks to its use in proving the alleged German plan for Jewish extermination, the Wannsee Protocol. All the information in this document is judged credible and convincing, except for its emigration statistics. On page 4 of the protocol, the following figures are given. From the assumption of power until the October 31st, 1941 deadline, altogether around 537,000 Jews emigrated. From January the 30th, 1933, from the Old Reich, about 360,000. From March the 15th, 1938, from the Ostmark, about 147,000. From March the 15th, 1939, from the Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia, about 30,000. And I'm not very good at adding up, but I make that at least about a million. About a million Jews in all that were able to get out with the aid of the Germans. And Adolf Eichmann said he helped hundreds of thousands of Jews get out of Germany. In his trial, he said that. And it was doubted.
Yeah. Which is probably why it's not widely known. Or Mr. Black, who wrote the book in 1986, his parents disowned him.
Well, I mean, these are the figures from the Wannsee Protocol, which is often used, isn't it?
Yeah, it's often used as saying that they had a meeting to discuss the extermination as well, according to HBO, anyway.
And they say that that was where they had the meeting, but what was the evidence of it?
Well, there was never any evidence.
I think, is that where the term the final solution was used, but they didn't actually specify what it meant?
That could be what you're saying. I know people who watch the HBO movie obviously believe the HBO movie to be true, which it isn't.
Well, obviously what was going on at this Wannsee Protocol, they were talking about the emigration of Jews because these figures are there and they sound they sound reasonable. They do sound reasonable.
That's right.
We shall not question the authenticity of the protocols here, nor comment on the significance of the meeting at the Wannsee Villa, which has recently received a different interpretation. What is important here is to point out once again the tendency of establishment historiography arbitrarily to designate certain parts of a document as authentic, while rejecting other portions as inauthentic. As for our investigation, we stand by our statement that exact emigration figures are not available. About a quarter to a third of the emigrants went to Palestine, a third to European countries, and the rest overseas, especially to North and South America. The Havarah, as stated at the beginning, is occasionally mentioned in specialised publications but seldom in the public media. The Rubley-Wolfat agreement is practically unknown. Most Germans are certainly well informed about the Holocaust, but have scarcely heard of the emigration plan that enabled the large majority of German Jews to depart unmolested. This is apparently one of the truths undesirable for national pedagogy, as Walter Höfer once formulated it. The historian's task will always be to swim against the stream and to help discover truths with which to bring the past into clear focus. And that really does help to bring it into focus, because I've always thought, why would there have been a problem between the nationalists and the Zionists when they were both nationalists? They both based their thinking on ethnicity. They were both ethnocentric. And obviously the Zionists would have wanted to go to Israel. The Germans wanted to, or the National Socialists wanted to get the Jews out of Germany. So naturally they're going to be wanting to work together. And why is that seen as a negative thing today? It's just logical that is what was likely to happen, and yet they'll try to portray it today as it being a bad thing. And also, it made me think, well, you're all supposed to be anti-Zionist, but for this period in time, I don't think I could be anti-Zionist. I think what they were doing was a noble aim to try and build a homeland for their people. And if you're a nationalist, you want that for all nations. You don't just want it for your own people. So, I wouldn't describe myself as being anti-Zionist. I'm against Zionist influence in other governments, and I'm against the influence of all foreign governments within a nationalist government. But as far as Jews having their own country and running it how they want to run it and having it for their people, then best of luck to them. And the fact that there are already another people there are already Palestinians there, that is unfortunate, but that is the way that it has happened throughout history. That there's always going to be another group of people that are living in a country that somebody else wants to move into. That's just the way of things. And the strongest group wins. And the strongest group is usually the best group, which is why white people won throughout history. But now we've suddenly decided that we don't need to rule the world anymore, and we can just give it up, and nobody else is going to want to rule the world either, which of course isn't true. And we see negative forces that are having an influence now, and we see the forces of chaos and revolution everywhere. Whereas if we had our old system and we had a monarchy, I think, and we had hierarchies, and everything was based upon race and ethnicity, things would be a lot different. What say you, Dennis?
Well, it's interesting because, as we mentioned last week about this declaration of war, only a month after Biden's come to power by Ukraine. I mean, the latest on that was that Putin has now warned the US not to send, as intended, two warships to the area. So things are beginning to hot up out there. But it's the hawks behind Biden, and these are the same people behind the Twin Towers, what then caused all the mayhem down in the Middle East. And it's a troubling, worrying time, to be honest.
Well, there's a lot of subversion that goes on, and a lot of it is to benefit Israel. And, you know, we could see there that their intelligence services are second only to the CIA in size. And mm-hmm. But they are just doing things that are to the benefit of their people. Basically, they're doing what's best for Jews, which we should expect them to do. But we should also expose it and be doing what is best for our people and be saying, look, these policies that our governments are engaged in, they're not benefiting us. They're benefiting Jews. But that's not to blame Jews for doing that. That's to say, well, you know, they've done very well to achieve that. You can't resent them for doing it.
Well, interesting enough, there's a video on YouTube at the moment which shows, I don't know whether you can remember Biden, when as soon as he came into office, he was signing all these declarations. And this video on YouTube, actually, you can actually hear him with the volume turned up. He's actually not understanding or not knowing what he's signing, but he's signing anyway, which leads, of course, to the point that Biden is not in charge. It's other people behind him are in charge. Looks like fun and games.
Well, he's like a puppet, isn't he?
That's exactly what he is, yeah.
He's got an earpiece in his ear that tells him what to say, and you've got these forces in the background that are telling him what to say. And there used to be a lot more in the background, but they're not anymore. They're quite open and upfront about it.
That's opposition.
AIPAC and the Jewish lobby in America, and you've got politicians in America pledging support for Israel and the Zionist state, and they should be pledging support to America. They shouldn't be pledging support to another state. And that is a problem with white Americans. You know, that's the point I wish to make. It's not a problem with Jews that they do this. They're obviously just doing what's best for them. The problem is with white people. We are not doing what is right for us. And it started with the war, really, going to war against our brothers in Germany. Yeah. And the outcome of that was this multiculturalism that we have to put up with now. And we're taught that it's a good thing and it's a strength and it's great for us, and it's not great for us. It's of benefit to everybody else, bar white people. And it's white people that need to change. It's white people that we make these programs for. We're not making these programs to try and be offensive or to be hostile to other groups. We're making these programs to try and wake up a love within our own people and an understanding of history and why we're in the situation that we are in today, because we've turned our back on all our traditions. As you've shown in all your documentaries, Dennis, this replacement of Christian values and traditional values that has been replaced with these multicultural values that don't benefit us.
Yeah.
But they do benefit these other groups. That's the thing. That's what people need to wake up to. When they say this is going to be of benefit to your country, it's not going to be of benefit to us. It's of benefit to them.
Yeah, especially when nothing's been voted on.
Yeah, well, again, if they were to actually give us a vote, then things would be different, wouldn't they? But who was it who put these people in power? We put them in power in the first place, and they're there representing us. It's what I say, you know, we can complain about what is going on to an extent, but we do have to take responsibility for it, because it is our country, it is our systems, it is our government that we put in place. They are our representatives. And if they're doing what we don't like, we really only have ourselves to blame. You can't blame Jews, which are just a tiny percentage of the population. They don't have any strength. You can't blame women. You know, they don't have the body strength. And they were wives and mothers until we decided to put them in the workforce and make them our equals. And it was us that decided to make Jews our equals. We're our own worst enemies, really. And that's who we need to overcome. We need to overcome the side of us, the weak side of us that gives into these things and that turns its back on our ancestral traditions. We need to turn our back on that and take the hard route instead of the easy route and set a good example for people in our own Amen. Individual lives.
Yeah.
Right.
Amen
well, thank you very much for coming on tonight, Dennis.
Okay.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.